Great. So today we have Hongwan Liu from Princeton and NYU as our speaker, and he will tell us about dark photons and the cosmic radiation background. Please feel free to start, Hongwan.
Thanks, Christina. So today I'm going to tell you a little bit about some relatively recent work on dark photons, the cosmic microwave background, as well as the cosmic radio background. And the work on dark photons and the CMB is based on these two papers that I'm showing you here in collaboration with Andrea Caputo, Siddharth Mishra Sharma, and Josh Ruderman. And then the part about the cosmic radio background is related to some upcoming work that also includes Maxim Pospelov. So just going to jump right in, and you know, I'm not even going to, in interest of time, because I think I have quite a bit of material to cover. I hope you're convinced that there's lots of evidence for dark matter across a wide range of length scales, but we don't really know what it is. And here I'm showing you some examples of what it could be, some very well-motivated examples for what it could be. Well, we don't really know which of these, you know, models it could be, and we have plenty of very good tests and very good constraints for some of these models. But I'll just jump right into the paradigm that I'm going to take for the rest of the talk, which is this idea of dark sectors. And sorry, before I jump into that, I just want to welcome any questions or comments throughout the talk. You can feel free to interrupt me at any time. Right. But the idea, the common paradigm that people have when we talk about dark sectors is that over on one side, there's all the standard model particles that we know and love, such as, you know, electrons, quarks, and so on. And then on the other side, we have a dark sector, which comprises the dark matter and any other additional dark particles that may or may not contribute to the dark matter itself, as well as other new forces that may exist in the dark sector. And these sectors are mostly separate with their own interactions. But then there is a small, you know, mediator, some kind of particle that bridges the gap between these two sectors, and, you know, has a tiny little mixing between some standard model particle and a dark sector particle. So in this case, I'm showing you the very standard case of the dark photon, which is the idea that a dark sector has a photon-like particle, an A prime. In this case, the A prime can be massive, and there is a small kinetic mixing between the standard model photon gamma, as well as the dark sector dark photon A primes. And this idea of having this A prime and having it, you know, mediate between the standard model sector and the dark sector is very popular. The dark photons can have a wide range of masses, going all the way from massless all the way up to, you know, GV, TV ranges. All of that has been studied in great detail. In terms of what the dark matter could be, you could add another particle in the dark sector. Here, I'm just labeling it as chi. And this dark matter can be charged under the dark photon. And so it's as if you have another copy of essentially QED in the dark sector with the dark matter being charged under the dark QED. And so these interactions generate an interaction between chis and standard model particles. Or another possibility that many people have considered is that the light dark photons can be all of dark matter itself. So there could be nothing else in the dark sector other than this A prime and these often very, very light A primes. So something like in the mass range of, you know, micro EV down to 10 to the minus 20 EV or so, there are viable mass ranges where these light dark photons can actually form all of dark matter itself. In this talk, we don't really care about what the dark matter actually is. All we're interested in is that there is this A prime. Well, at least in the first part of the talk, we'll just care that there is such a thing called an A prime and there is some small kinetic mixing. And then maybe in the second part of the talk, we'll introduce what the dark matter component could be. Okay, so one immediate thing that comes from introducing a mixing between gammas and A primes is that if you think about the fact that, you know, the conventional gammas and the are now, you know, able to kind of transition into an A prime, it becomes clear that, you know, the propagation eigenstates that you want to think about becomes different from the interaction eigenstates, right? So for example, the standard model becomes charged under the interaction eigenstates of the photon, but this interaction eigenstate is not a propagation eigenstate because there is this mixing and gammas can actually transition into A primes. And so this produces something that we're going to call dark photon oscillations. And this is not something that's new at all. This is exactly what happens when it comes to mixing in neutrinos. So for example, if you produce an electron neutrino through some interaction involving the W and the electron, and you produce a neutrino in the electron interaction eigenstate or the flavor eigenstate, this flavor eigenstate can mix with the other flavor eigenstates, and you could transition, for example, from an electron neutrino to a muon neutrino. And so the electron neutrino is not a propagation eigenstate. And the same thing applies to photons and dark photons, if dark photons exist. So for example, you could have a photon, you could produce a photon in, for example, an RF cavity, you could emit a photon, and then this photon can bounce around inside the cavity, and at some point it can oscillate into an A prime. And this A prime is, remember, it's an interaction eigenstate, and it doesn't interact with, presumably it doesn't interact with the surfaces of the cavity, and so it can escape. And then at some far away point, you can put another RF cavity, and this A prime can actually oscillate back into the standard photon. So this is essentially the same idea as neutrino oscillations that I said before. And this kind of setup is one experimental way that people have considered, which is generally called the light shining through wall experiment. This is a setup that people have used to think about how to discover the existence of an A prime mixed with a gamma. So all this should be pretty familiar. So let's put in some numbers for, like, you know, what are the characteristic length scales that we expect gammas to oscillate into A primes and so on. And if you work out what the probability of oscillation between a gamma and an A prime, this is just a simple quantum mechanics problem. You find that the probability of oscillation of a gamma into A prime after traveling some distance L is proportional to the mixing squared, which is something that we expect, right? The smaller the mixing, the smaller the probability of transition. And then it goes as some kind of sine squared of L with some, you know, wave number that scales as like MA prime squared over omega. And if you ask, you know, If you go for too short of a length, then you don't give the photons enough time to transition to an A prime. And so you can ask, you know, what is sort of the characteristic length at which we get an oscillation length for, you know, a maximum conversion of gammas to A primes. And if you plug in some numbers, this L scales as the frequency of the photon that you produced here, divided by the mass of the A prime, the mass of this particle squared. And you get something like, you know, 1 meter for an MA prime of 10 to the minus 6 EV for a frequency of a gigahertz or so, which is where we are when we do these RF cavity experiments. Okay, so the length scales that you can get away with is about a meter, which is, you know, human scales, and this applies for masses of about 10 to the minus 6 EV or so. So these kinds of experiments are very good in this range. But of course, you know, MA prime didn't have to be 10 to the minus 6 EV. It could have been something lighter. And if you put that into this probability of transition, you find that the characteristic oscillation length that comes out is, you know, 10 to the 6 meters, which is much more challenging for us on terrestrial scales. So, you know, you need to position your transmitter and your receiver at distances that are comparable to the size of the Earth, which you know, it's very impractical. So this becomes very difficult with terrestrial probes. And of course, now you need to start thinking about larger and larger scales. And the natural thing that you would think of is, are there astrophysics probes or are there cosmological probes for these kinds of oscillations between gammas and A primes that can give us useful constraints? And also another thing is that all of the previous discussion that I've given about the probability of transition assumes that these oscillations take place in vacuum. And we haven't taken into account that, you know, if you propagate in a medium which has a different, different refractive index, different plasma mass, different plasma frequency compared to a vacuum, you could get effects where the propagation medium can really help. And so these are some things that point the way to looking at cosmological length scales or astrophysical length scales to probe such light A primes. Okay, so before I go on, are there any quick questions? If not, I'll jump right into telling you how you can constrain dark photon oscillations with the cosmic microwave background. And this is, was put forward initially in 2009 in this paper, and then these are some additional ideas as recently as 2019. And the idea is, like I said, to make use of, again, you know, cosmological length scales, cosmological time scales, plus the fact that there is some in-medium effects that are different from just oscillations in the vacuum. And so, as I alluded to earlier, there is this fact that because, you know, of the composition of the universe, you do have some free electrons per unit volume floating around in the universe on average. And these free electrons contribute to the plasma frequency or plasma mass of the medium, the cosmological plasma. And so you actually find that in medium, the photons that travel through the universe actually have some kind of effective mass. And this effective mass, if I plot it as a function of redshift, it scales with essentially the free electron fraction times the mean electron number density today. The mean electron number density as a function of redshift. And so if you just plot what the homogeneous plasma mass is, so for now, just assuming that the entire universe is completely homogeneous, you find that, you know, from the point of recombination at about a redshift of 1,000 to reionization at about 10 all the way down till today, you find that the plasma mass due to the presence of free electrons varies from something like 10 to the minus 9 EV near recombination all the way down to about 10 to the minus 14 EV during as it is today. And so under the assumption of homogeneity, you have this effective mass here. And the point is that this effective mass is precisely the in-medium effects that I told you could actually modify the probability of conversions significantly. So what actually happens? So imagine if you have some A prime with a mass MA prime that lies somewhere between 10 to the minus 14 to 10 to the minus 9 EV, right? You have some photons that are traveling throughout the universe. For example, they're part of the cosmic microwave background. As they travel, the universe redshifts and the free electron fraction decreases due to either recombination or due to the fact that the universe is, well, it's just expanding, so the density is dropping, right? And so the plasma mass of the photons that are in the universe drops as a function of time. And at some point, you hit this special point where M gamma, the effective plasma mass of the photon, is equal to MA prime. I'm kind of omitting the details of why this resonant, why there is some special point here where you have M gamma equals MA prime. But essentially, you can think of these two states, this gamma and A prime states, as being a two-level system in quantum mechanics. And initially, when M gamma is, for example, much greater than MA prime, you have one level that is much at a much higher energy than the other level. And so there's it's difficult to transition between the two. But at the point where M gamma is equal to MA prime, there's actually, you know, like you have two degenerate levels. And at this point, you actually get a resonance conversion between gammas and A primes as well as vice versa. And so you get a very efficient boost in the probability of transitions at this point, and you get a sudden production of A primes when this happens. parametrically, if I put in what the probability of oscillation is, if you compare it to what we had before in vacuum, previously we said it scaled like epsilon squared times the length times some characteristic inverse length scale given by ma prime squared over 2 omega. Now we find that the probability of conversion still scales, you know, very similarly. It scales with the epsilon squared. It scales with this characteristic inverse length, ma prime squared over 2 omega. But instead of having, you know, some length scale that you put in here, it's replaced by essentially the rate of change of m gamma squared as a function of time. And if you work this out, remember m gamma squared is just determined by the electron number density. And in the homogeneous limit, this number density is just redshifting, right? And so the characteristic time scale at which m gamma squared changes is exactly given by the Hubble time scale. And so now your probability is the same factors as before, but instead of a length scale L here, you get something much, much bigger, and it's given by H inverse. And so this buys you a much larger probability of conversion due to this in medium effect.
Question?
Yes.
So if this plasma is inhomogeneous, right? Like if there is short wavelength variation such as this, m gamma equals to m a prime, this condition meets multiple times, right?
Yep. Exactly, yeah. So that's actually the main calculation that we did that I'm going to describe to you soon.
Okay.
So yeah, you're right. At this point, we're still thinking in terms of homogeneous calculations, which was what had been done up till the 2019 paper that I talked about. And so if we go back and look at the... let me just, I don't actually have the slide, that is strange, but I think let's just go back to this plot here. The idea is that, you know, as M gamma changes with time, let's say if you have an MA prime that is 10 to the minus 10 EV, assuming everything is homogeneous, then at some point the plasma mass is gonna match the A prime mass here. It's gonna happen at a redshift of about 1,000 or so, so just after recombination, you're gonna get a large probability of conversion at this point. And so a lot of the photons that are present in the universe are gonna convert into A primes. Well, proportional to epsilon squared. So the idea is, because you're gonna get these conversions from gammas to A primes, then you're gonna get very strong constraints coming from the cosmic microwave background. And so just to remind everyone, I'm sure many of you know this.
Can I interrupt you before you kind of carry on?
Go ahead.
The formula that you have there in the bottom right there, that was on your previous slide. Yeah, that one. Mm-hmm. That, I'm just thinking about how neutrinos would have worked. That looks like a Landau-Zener kind of expression.
It's exactly Landau-Zener.
And what you're giving here, if I understand it right, is that's the jump probability, is it? Or is that the... You know, so what happens in Landau-Zener is that if you're adiabatic, then you completely convert, and if you go through it very quickly, then you kind of jump from, as the levels cross, you jump from one to the other.
Yes.
And so, my intuition, what you're writing here is it the jump probability, or is this the probability of doing a conversion? If p were one, would that have been an adiabatic transition, or would that have been a complete jump from one leg to the other?
It is exactly the Landau-Zener jump probability. Yeah,
it's a jump probability. Okay. So then, what's kind of counterintuitive is that you're getting in that last factor, the rate of change of m squared sounds like that's the thing that's governing how quickly you jump, right? Or how quickly you make the transition through the resonant region.
That's right.
And my intuition there is that if you do that quickly, then you jump. There's a good chance of it jumping. Your likelihood of jumping is high. Whereas you do it slowly, then you're very adiabatic, and then you have the resonant transition. And the fact that you're so that makes it sound like your jump probability should be amplified the quicker you do the transition. Whereas it sounds like if the scale of this thing is going with the Hubble scale, you're winning by having it take less time at some level, if you see what I mean. And that's I'm trying to understand why it's true that the slower you go through that transition, the longer that rate of change, the slower the rate of change is, so the longer the time scale is for that rate of change, the more likely it is that you do the jump. That seems like that's the opposite of what my Landau-Zener intuition would have been.
Okay, let's see. So the slower it is, sorry, the slower it is, the slower it is, the smaller d log m gamma squared over dt is, right? And then
the slower it is, then
the rate of change is smaller, right?
I want to say that sounds reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, and then you take the inverse, right?
But somehow, though, that this the time scale that you're putting in a time scale there, right?
Yeah.
And I guess what my puzzle is coming from is I'm thinking that that's the time scale you're spent in the resident region, and maybe that's the wrong thing. So maybe that's what it is. The way I should read this is that your factor ma squared over omega is telling me how fast I go through the resident region, and I'm comparing that to the rate with which the mass is changing. Is that right?
No. You're right. So you're right. So the length of time you spend in the resonance time scale is I think it's this epsilon squared times ma prime squared over omega.
Okay. So I'll think about that some more. So now a related question is, I know that in the neutrino case, this is all assuming that you've got a very good mean field description of what's going on. And there's a correction to all this, which comes from fluctuations in the environment you're moving through. And it has its biggest effects when the correlation length in the fluctuations is comparable to your oscillation length at resonance. Have people thought through how big the fluctuations are in this kind of a medium?
So this is exactly what I'm going to come to. So,
I'll wait for you. I'll ask it again.
Yeah. Sounds good. Inhomogeneities. Yes.
Okay.
So as I was saying, because you have these gammas to A prime oscillations, one of the immediate things that you might think of is that because you have a perfect black body of the CMB, imagine if you have some of these resonant conversions occurring at, you know, sometime after recombination at, you know, a redshift of, let's say, 500 or so, right? So what's going to happen is you have some probability of conversion. So some of this, some of the photons that you see in the black body is going to disappear. And it actually scales as 1/(ω). And so you're going to get a lot more of these lower frequency photons disappearing. And so if you compare, this is the black body distribution with the data points shown in red. And if you just plot the residuals with, in terms of, you know, fitting the data points of a black body, you get these points in red. And then if some of it disappears due to gamma to A prime oscillations, you're going to get the blue dotted line here. And in this case, you can see that there's going to be some constraint for these model parameters because you have disappearing non-black body photons at this point. Okay, so that's quite a straightforward idea. This is an idea that is quite old. It was done, like I said, you know, first done in 2009 and improved in 2019, all under the assumption of homogeneities. And so now, as you know, many of you have astutely realized, all of that was under the homogeneous assumption. And as you know, the homogeneous assumption is broken very badly at late times, especially because, you know, structures form and so on, and you get inhomogeneities in the medium. And so this is the main contribution that we had in the two papers that I described before. At roughly the same time as we were doing this, there were some other groups that were looking at it from a numerical perspective. And so, for example, these papers here are also related, and generally all three papers agree very well with our results as well. Okay, so what happens in reality, as many people have already realized, you have fluctuations in the electron density, and that's going to mean that, you know, if you have a photon passing through all of these fluctuations that I'm showing you here, at the top, you're going to run into regions where you have a high number density of electrons or a low number density of electrons, and you're going to get some fluctuations in m gamma as you travel along. So here I'm plotting, I'm taking some slice of some simulation that we did, and we fix ma prime to have this particular mass here of roughly 10 to the minus 13 eV or so. And so if you just took the homogeneous treatment, which is the dashed line here, right? What you will see is that, well, okay, you're going to get transitions, resonance transition, because the homogeneous plasma mass is going to intersect with the Ma prime at a redshift of 100 or so. So you're going to get a ton of transitions here, and then nothing's going to happen above and below redshift 100, which is the resonance redshift. But of course, you know, as you travel through this one particular park here, you can see that there are all these fluctuations in the density. And you can see that even at you know, high redshift at 107, for example, there is one intersection, right, where you travel through a particularly underdense region, and M gamma happened to cross MA prime at this point. And so you do expect some resonance transitions to occur here as well. And then you get tons of transitions, you know, across some broad band around 100. And then that effect kind of goes away at late times.
Yeah, may I ask you, so what kind of simulations is that? So, I mean, turbulence, how do you take into account turbulence, or you don't?
We don't, right? So this is very a very simple, just, you know, take a matter power spectrum and generate a realization of the Gaussian statistics based on that matter power spectrum.
So just a Gaussian random field.
Yes, here. Gaussian random field. We do a log normal case that I think I have my backup slides, but here in this particular one, it's just a Gaussian random field, which is good approximation above Z of 20 or so. Yeah.
Okay.
So is the power spectrum assumed here a baryon power spectrum, or is it like the matter power spectrum?
Good. So I don't remember exactly what we used here. I think it's the baryon power spectrum that we put in. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so it's accounting for the residual coupling between the baryons and the CMB.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So there is this subtlety that we do deal with as well. I think in this simulation we did put in a baryon power spectrum. Yes.
But you don't put any halos or any clusters inside here.
No. So at least for this simulation it's a Z of 100, so no halos yet. Yeah.
Will be different than CDM. The power spectrum of baryons in CDM should be pretty similar to 100, no?
I think that's right. I think by Z of 200, they're quite similar. I think that's right. Yeah.
There's some heating still, right? I mean, of the baryons from the CMB, and so there'll be some genes length. And so I don't know, on this plot, what that genes length translates to.
I see.
Good. No. You're right. So you're right that compared to CDM, there is a genes length, and we do put in the genes length is actually very important for us. And I think in this version of the talk, I might have truncated all of that specifics, but there is a genes length that we put in for the baryon power spectrum that happens to be like roughly, I think 1 KPC or so, one co-moving KPC or so. Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving on, the idea is that, you can see that, you know, there's one transition here, and there's one transition here, and then there is some distribution of transitions between, you know, 105 down to 95, and then that kind of goes away at low redshifts. And so you can actually, you know, kind of bin it and ask what is the analytic crossing probability, and this is the curve that what is the crossing probability? And this is the curve that we get. Let me say that again. That was confusing. So the red lines tells you how often the transitions occur. And you can see that they're very dense at a redshift of 100 or so, which is where the mean is. And then it turns out that we can actually do an analytic estimate for what you think the crossing probability is as a function of redshift. So in other words, we can actually effectively it turns out that we can actually effectively average over all photon paths analytically, which is somewhat surprising. Like, it's surprising that you can do this analytically, but it turns out that you can. And this is because if you think about how these transitions are occurring, you're just looking for some circumstances where, you know, M gamma matches MA prime. And so you're looking for some probability of a Gaussian random field attaining some value. And it turns out that this idea of, you know, finding out what the expected number of crossings that you expect a Gaussian random field to like how often you expect a Gaussian random field to hit a certain value is actually a very well understood problem in stochastic processes in mathematics. So we actually borrowed a proof of a theorem called Rice's theorem to actually figure out how to analytically average over photon paths. And because it's actually simple enough, I can actually just show you how this works. So previously we went through this probability of conversion, and we had said, you know, it's proportional to 1/omega, but also this characteristic time scale, d log m gamma squared dt inverse. And it turns out that you can just, you know, rewrite this thing here as like a Jacobian. And it's the Jacobian of this delta function integrated over some time t. And, you know, this is just a standard delta function identity. You can transform from the right-hand side to the left-hand side. And it kind of makes sense. Like you're basically just counting, you know, the number of times m gamma squared crosses m a prime squared. So it's some delta function integrated over time. And so this is the probability written in a different way. And now what we want to do is we want to take some kind of averaging over, you know, all possible, take some kind of ensemble average over, you know, the Gaussian random field fluctuations. Or later on, you'll find that actually it doesn't even matter if it's Gaussian or not. You want to just take some average over the field configurations. And so what you do is, well, okay, if you look at this part of the integral, it really only depends on m gamma squared as a function of time, right? So if you imagine you have one photon traveling around along some path, and you have some, you know, m gamma squared as a function of time for that particular path. And now all you have to do is just essentially just average over what you expect the distribution of m gamma squared to be as a function of time. And so you just need to put in the probability density function of m gamma squared at each time and integrate over all m gamma squareds here. And then if you look at this integral, this is really an easy integral to do because there's a delta function here. And so you can just do it. And the final result is that you get the mean probability of conversion, the total probability of conversion for photons to A primes. And this is just some time integration over time of this prefactor that we've seen already, times the probability density function of M gamma squared being attaining this value m a prime squared at time t. Okay, so we've basically reduced the entire problem of, you know, finding the average conversion probability to knowing what the PDF of the plasma mass squared is. And this turns out to not be such a hard problem because if you think back to what the definition of m gamma is, right, m gamma was just given by essentially, you know, it's just directly proportional to n sub e. And if you just look at m gamma squared proportional to n sub e, you find that the probability distribution function of m gamma squared as a function of t is just going to be directly proportional to the one-point PDF of baryon fluctuations. Okay. So at this point, I think there are a lot of cosmologists in this talk, and you might be worried that there are also fluctuations in X of E. And that is true, and there, we have a much more extensive discussion of this in our paper. But roughly speaking, you can find a way to relate M gamma squared to the one-point probability of delta B. Okay, so all we have to do now is to just relate this to P delta B of T. And it turns out, for example, if you think about the linear regime where Z is much greater than 20, and you can characterize the fluctuations as small and Gaussian, then the probability one-point PDF of delta B is just a Gaussian. And it's just given by, you know, exponential of delta B squared over some variance sigma B squared. And the variance of fluctuations, as we know, is an integral over the power spectrum of baryons. And this is where the distinction between, as I alluded to earlier on as well, the distinction between matter power spectrum and baryon power spectrum becomes very important, because in the baryon power spectrum, there is a natural cutoff at the gene scale, right? And so this enables you to cut off the power spectrum above some wavelength. And so this gives you a finite sigma b squared instead of the case with the matter power spectrum. Okay, so yeah, so this was something that I already said, which is that sigma b squared is just the integral over the power spectrum, which you can get at high redshifts. It's just the linear matter power, the linear baryon power spectrum, which can be computed easily. Okay, so with the 1-point PDF, it's just directly proportional to the 1-point PDF of m gamma squared, and that's going to give you the mean conversion probability p gamma to a prime averaged over all possible paths. Okay, and so all of that math that I did earlier on is seemed pretty straightforward, but we also wanted to make sure that what we were doing made sense in simulations. And so what we did here was to run a Gaussian simulation, so a Gaussian random field simulation with a power spectrum that we put in. And here we're showing you what happens if you draw just lines of photons traveling through this regions of over and under density and computing the DP, like the probability of the differential probability of conversion as a function of Z, and plotting it here. And so from the Gaussian simulation, which we show in the dashed lines here, this is the distribution of, this is the expected DP gamma to A prime DZ that we found by drawing lines through this simulation. And the analytic result is in red. And you can see here that the agreement is very good. And so we think that the whole math formalism that we showed you earlier, works.
All right. Ask you another question before you move on.
Yes.
So I'm thinking it's not quite the same problem, but it sounds similar in spirit that kind of the way you're setting this up, as I understand it, is that you've got what you really had was a spatially inhomogeneous distribution, mm-hmm. and then you're modeling that by saying that if I coarse grain on scales that are large compared to the size of the inhomogeneities, I can think of that as being on average a uniform distribution with fluctuations in it. And I'm interested in the extent to which those fluctuations are changing my resonance condition, right? That's the way you're modeling it, if I understand it right.
Yeah, that's right.
But a related thing that happens when you have spatial inhomogeneity is that because you're microscopically, if you thought of like light moving through a cloud or something like that, microscopically, what's happening is because it's not translation invariant, you get scattering from these inhomogeneities, which at the level of the mean field approximation you're using will look like scattering from the fluctuations. It'll be corrections to the mean field approximation. And so that should be depleting your beam at some level, at the level that you're seeing the fluctuations being relevant to your resonance. And I remember when people did this for neutrinos, there was an effect like that. If you could generalize the Landau's inner description, but there was an effect where the fluctuations actually damped the transmission at resonance. But it sounds like the way you're describing it, you're not following that scattering process. Is that because it's small, or how do you see that the effect that you're tracking is to the extent that you see the fluctuations in the resonance? How do you know that the scattering from those fluctuations is also not important?
Do you mean like photon scattering off the overdensities?
Yeah, because at some level you've got these photons that are moving through an environment where their plasma mass is a function of position because the density is a function of position. Yeah. And so that's in general going to be mean that their trajectories are going to change as they move through this plasma, right?
Right. Right. I think to first order, all of the photons make it through just because the universe is essentially transparent after recombination. And these fluctuations are not like orders of magnitude fluctuations. These are like small, right? Especially at early times.
Well, there's two effects. So there's one that I know from the example of neutrinos and light that the one effect is the amplitude of the fluctuation, but another effect is the correlation time of the fluctuation. And it becomes particularly dangerous if that correlation time is comparable to the time you go through the resonance window. Because then you kind of get the biggest effect from your oscillations, but that's also when the scattering for those particular photons is the highest. And for neutrinos, it's true that the interactions as a whole are very weak, so that the mean field is normally really good. But for photons, it's kind of dangerous because the interactions with the environment are rising at the same order in alpha as the scattering is, essentially. And so normally there's a coherence part to the story, which is tricky to keep track of. And I don't know to what extent it's relevant to the cosmology, though.
I'm not 100% sure. I think I just don't know enough about this right now. But I do have to say that this effect is a forward, like this effect of like changes in a plasma mass is a forward scattering process, right?
Right.
And so I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but like the interaction rate of that is much more important than individual scatterings, right? So for example, like the universe is transparent to photons, but the changes in the plasma mass does actually affect the propagation of photons significantly. So,
right. Like, but the way I understand that in ordinary matter is that it's kind of a miracle, right? Because it's what justifies the first order approximation is why is anything transparent? Because if you're actually seeing matter effects that change the index of refraction by a large amount, then you could say, well, why is it true that you're not, that the depletion of forward direction scattering is suppressed? And the answer to that normally is that the wavelength of the photons you're looking at are very long compared to the spacing of the scatterers. So you're coherently scattering in the forward direction and incoherently scattering to the side. So there's a large N kind of limit that controls everything.
Yeah, this is true here as well, right?
Yeah, but I believe that's generally true. But once you start looking at the fluctuations changing the physics through the resonance, you're starting to look at the physics that cares about those fluctuations. And I'm wondering now at that point, is that do you have to rethink the coherence story for those resonant fluctuations to trust what you're doing?
I think this is interesting. I don't actually know enough about this physics to comment very clearly now. And maybe if you tell me more about this after the talk, it would be pretty interesting to check this.
Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you. That's probably good to follow up later on. Yeah, sounds good.
I think I have a related question. So how the size of inhomogeneities, I mean, the genes length, how does it compare to the oscillation length? Is it much bigger, much smaller, or what?
So let's see. So what do you mean by the oscillation length? You mean the...
Well, it takes some length, yeah, to oscillate from photon to the dark photon, right?
That would be your omega squared over ma or something.
Even on resonance, yeah, it doesn't happen instantaneously. I mean, adiabaticity should not be violated. Yeah, so basically, I think that's my question. So. The should be large, yeah, compared to the. I mean, the density should vary slowly, right, along the ray, so that adiabaticity is not violated. Otherwise, the formula will be different, right?
So I think the transition occurs at the like is this two level system idea again, right? And then you want to know like when, like how long it stays at the two level rate, right? And that's right. I think that's like the there's some kind of width to the two states, right? And I think that is epsilon, essentially it's epsilon squared ma prime squared over two omega, so it's suppressed by epsilon squared.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's much smaller than the size of these blobs.
Yeah, I would say it should be inversely proportional to epsilon, right? No, so you're saying it's epsilon square m over omega. Yeah, okay, so it's inverse length. So the length itself is omega over m square over epsilon square. So it's a large length, yeah? Before you were comparing it to the Hubble, which was okay, yeah, but now you are your inhomogeneities are much smaller, so I wonder if you can still treat them, you know, as a slowly varying density or not.
Yeah, maybe I'm saying something confusing here.
I'm not completely sure that you know yes, actually, yeah, I also wanted to ask a similar question, but I'm not sure which size of inhomogeneities are actually leading the effect, in the sense that there's a cutoff at high gene scale, sure, but the power spectrum also is just decaying as 1 over k cubed. So I'm not sure if the smallest inhomogeneities are the ones that are leading the effect.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, that's also a question. I mean, which one leads the effect? But in principle, they dominate the density fluctuations, yeah, because it's 1 over k cubed, but that's slow, yeah? Plus there is some log. So, okay, so it diverges as log, yeah, and then it's cut.
Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, based on that log divergence, I think it's the small.
No, it's not the log over K cube. So the K cube, just bigger K cube is.
No, it's K cubed.
Yeah.
It's K to the minus 3, and then you integrate here. So it's a log.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
The log, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Plus yeah. Enhancement. There's a different
okay.
Enhancement. So it's log yeah. Square, the log cube, by the
way. Right, right.
Yeah. So it is the small, like the small regions that are giving you these conversions. And those regions are about 1 KPC comoving. And then, yeah, this question about the resonance length, I think I'm confusing myself. And I need to refresh my memory about it. It's been a while since we worked this out in the paper, but we did worry about this, and we did find that the length over which it transitions,
mm-hmm.
It's much smaller than the, much smaller than these fluctuations. But I think I'm a little bit confused, and I will think mm-hmm. about it maybe after the talk, and we can talk some more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. So. What do we do in the nonlinear regime? So this one is much harder, right? Because in the nonlinear regime, you're going to get some PDF. Well, it's not going to be Gaussian anymore, and so you can't model it through a Gaussian mean field. And so we need to find a new way to parameterize the PDF in the nonlinear regime. And so in the nonlinear regime, we actually take some more sort of phenomenological approaches. So we have a PDF that looks like a log normal distribution. And then with that PDF, we again take the variance from the power spectrum and we take a nonlinear power spectrum at late times to include the fact that, you know, you have nonlinear effects coming into play. But of course, like it is true that in the nonlinear regime, things are a little bit more uncertain. And to skip through all of that details, because I actually have actually maybe about half an hour of material to go through, but the punchline is that we do set interesting new constraints with inhomogeneities. So if you look at the line, the dotted line that I'm highlighting here, this was the previous calculation assuming a homogeneous universe. And you can see that there are these sudden transitions occurring because there are, you know, sudden cases where you suddenly go from a point where you have transitions that are allowed for, you know, less than 4 times 10 to the minus 13 EV, but then suddenly they're not allowed because the homogeneous evolution doesn't pass through those values, for example. But if we take into account inhomogeneities with our method, we find that the distribution smooths out a lot more, except at high scales, of course, like fluctuations don't really matter because at these high masses, you are basically converting in a very homogeneous universe. So nothing really matters at high masses. But you can see here, even in some cases, you find that actually the previous homogeneous bounds were too strong. And we get significant improvement in a mass range of about 10 to minus 12 EV. And we're able to also push this out from about 10 to minus 14 EV or so down to close to 10 to minus 15 because of the fact that you can get underdensities as well. And you can get conversions in these underdensities. Okay, so in summary, dark photons can be probed by cosmology, and we think it is relatively easy to include inhomogeneities, although maybe it would be good to discuss some of these interesting subtleties that have been raised in this talk. All right, so I was gonna take some time to explain to you this arcade excess and a new model that we've come up with to explain this long-standing cosmic radio background anomaly. But I'll try to kind of summarize this as quickly as I can and hopefully give you a flavor of what we've been doing. So we know, as I've mentioned, that a CMB is a very perfect black body, but we don't measure it down. We don't measure it past roughly an energy of about 10 to minus 4 EV or so, right? So once you go down to, you know, less than 10 gigahertz or so, this is not measured by the Kolbe-Firas experiment. So what happens as you go down to much lower frequencies? And it turns out that there are, you know, a bunch of other experiments that have been trying to measure the radio background temperature as well. So you can see that here I'm plotting the temperature, the effective temperature of the radiation that they measure as a function of frequency. And the FIRES measurements are way up here. And you find, and people have found, you know, through a range of different experiments. Here on the left, I'm showing you some data points coming from the Arcade 2 experiment, but there are other radio telescopes such as the Parkes and Jodrell Bank telescope, LWA, and so on, that have tried to take measurements of what the temperature that they see is. And they find that there's a power law excess in the sky temperature as compared to the 2.7 kelvins that is measured by FIRES, right? So you can see here, you know, FIRES is somewhere here, and you can start seeing excesses of about 10 to minus 2 kelvins at 10 gigahertz. And this goes up to something as high as 10 to the 4 kelvins at roughly, you know, the tens of megahertz region. You can fit this power law and you get something that goes as, the temperature goes as the frequency to the minus 2.62. And if you're not familiar with what this radio temperature is, we can rephrase it in terms of dN gamma d omega. And this turns out to be omega to the minus 1.62 or so. And so this is a very long-standing result. Like, many of these experiments are quite old. The last update, there are a bunch of updates. LWA updated their results in 2018, and this Arcade 2 points here came in 2009. And people have been trying to figure out exactly what this power law is for quite a long time, actually. Note, this is subtracting out, after you subtract out the modeled galactic contribution. So this is the contribution that you expect from extra galactic sources. Another interesting thing about this emission, you know, not just that there is a huge excess, but also you can try to figure out whether this emission is smooth or not. If you look at the colored data points here, so this is a plot of the fluctuations on the y-axis as a function of the angular size of the fluctuations on the x-axis. And there are some experiments such as VLA and ATCA that have made, you know, upper limits on what they think the fluctuation is as a function of angular size. And they find, you know, these upper limits here. And if you just, you know, take the simplest assumption, right, you assume that the excess radio background is perfectly correlated with structure. So, you know, you just assign, you know, a radio emission coming from some structure to be, you know, much higher if it's much denser, for example. And then you try to figure out what kind of fluctuations you expect from this kind of model. And you get this curve here in black if you include all sources between a redshift of 0 and 1. And you can see here that the fluctuations that are expected at an L of about 10 to the 4 or so is much higher than the constraints that are set by these experiments. And so the only way to sort of get into agreement with these experimental results is to assume that either it is emitted at very high redshifts, which are all these, like, which are structures that are really far away from us, and that gets you down to this dashed curve here. Or you can assume that the emission only comes from very large structures, so structures that are, you know, 2 megaparsecs and above, and anything that's smaller than that does not emit this radio background. And then you can get into you get into one of these two curves here, and you can be consistent with these results. But the overall message is that the emission is actually extremely smooth. Which is quite puzzling and reminiscent of the CMB itself, right? Which is also very smooth.
I can ask, like, so at lower L, are there any constraints on this or no?
As far as I know, these are the only constraints that we have. And then Planck is a measurement up here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Like, and that Planck measurement isn't just like a monopole. You're saying that it's like at some L.
So this is for one of their maps, and I guess Yeah, I guess this is a, yeah, actually now kind of think of it, I'm not entirely sure where this data point comes from, but it's from one of the frequency maps, right? And then I guess it looks like some kind of close to a monopole, I guess. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to say. I mean, like the error bar goes out to like all of thousands. So.
Yeah, and but also at zero.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Maybe what? Sorry. Maybe what's happening is that this is some kind of like you just take the map, and for each pixel, compute delta t over t, right? And I think this might be what you get, and then the x axis error bar is like it spans the sensitivity of Planck, which is like L equals zero up to like 10^3.
L. Yeah, I mean, like, I guess I was just wondering, you know, if this excess could be attributed just to some sort of like, you know, wrong subtraction of our galaxy.
Yeah, good. So you can try to, yeah, so there is already a subtraction, right? And then you might say, well, okay, maybe it's subtracted incorrectly and that there are additional, backgrounds that you fail to subtract. The idea is that, you know, you could, for example, get have underestimated the synchrotron emission in the Milky Way, or you could have. So that's I guess one of the things that you're suggesting. And then there are a few other explanations, which is that on the extragalactic end as well, you're underestimating the amount of synchrotron that's being emitted from like radio galaxies or AGNs and so on. But the interesting thing about many of these proposals where they are trying to relate, you know, synchrotron to this excess is that synchrotron emission is always very tightly correlated to gamma rays as well, because synchrotron is produced by, you know, emitting high energy particles and they you know, go around magnetic fields. But at the same time, these high energy particles that are produced also undergo like inverse Compton scattering. And so you should also expect to see correlated gamma rays. So in general, a lot of these explanations tend to fail to produce the required emission that you need because of this correlation with high energy gamma rays. And there are the gamma rays that are being emitted tightly constrains the amount of synchrotron that can be produced in the Milky Way or in the extragalactic diffuse emission. Mm-hmm. Of course, it could still be that there are other mismodeling things, but I think the astronomers are kind of puzzled by this state of affairs right now.
Mm-hmm. So are there any polarization measurements of this excess?
That's a very good point. I don't think so, but there could be. I as far as I'm aware, no.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so there are some existing explanations, but for example, the usual astrophysics explanations do not give you a large enough amplitude. Like at most, you can turn it up to like 10% of the full amplitude. And then there are some, you know, slightly more exotic explanations that do kind of work. But none of them, like, you know, you can have supermassive black holes at Z of 20, and that kind of works. You can also have dark matter annihilation plus synchrotron from the annihilation products, plus some optimistic distribution of magnetic fields in galaxy clusters. And this also kind of works. But
can I ask you, so why doesn't, so how, when they say supermassive, how supermassive are they talking about?
I believe it's like 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 solar mass black holes. But I need to check.
Okay, so it's not the super, super, super massive. It's not 10 to the 10, like the, it's 10 to the 6. And
I mean, don't quote me on that. I definitely need to check, but my memory says 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
So how much time do I have left?
We are over time, but you had a lot of questions, so you can take a few more minutes.
Okay, so I'll just very briefly run through what the model is. And this is based on an earlier model by Pospelov et al. In 2018. And this was proposed to explain the edges anomaly. And actually, it might be able to explain both the edges anomaly and this radio access. We haven't confirmed that. But yet, the idea is that you need to generate some amount of these very low energy photons, right? So the idea is you have some dark matter axion-like particle A that is cosmologically stable, but not quite stable. It has some mass MA, and it can decay into two dark photons, just like regular axions, with some mass MA prime, with some effective coupling that we call G here. These A primes, again, free stream through the universe. And then at some point, if you again match the resonance conversion, the resonance point, resonance condition, you get these dark photons oscillating into visible photons in this case. So previously we were talking about photons going to A primes, but the opposite occurs as well. So you have A primes going into gammas, and these are the low energy photons that you want to explain the excess that I just described. And one additional ingredient on top of this that we now need is that we also need a relic background of A primes. So not only is A primes produced by A, but by the axion, but also there is some black body distribution of A primes at some temperature that we take to be less than the CMB that was produced in the early universe. And this is something that we need to get the right slope of the power law that I showed you earlier. So I was going to take you through exactly how this model would produce the correct power law. So if I want to remind you, the power law was that the temperature scaled as like minus 2.6 or so. And so the goal is to have dn gamma d omega being scaling as omega to the minus 3/2. And the way we get there is that from these kinds of decays of the dark matter going into two A primes, if you just work out the math, you get a dna prime. So the dark photon spectrum scales as omega to the half. And then, as we earlier discussed, the probability of conversion scales roughly as 1/(omega). And so after these A primes convert to photons, you get omega to the minus half as the spectrum of photons that you expect from this axion to two A primes, and then A primes to resonance conversion of photons. Well, this photon spectrum is omega to the minus half, but the goal that we needed was dn d omega of omega to the minus 3/2. So we're missing 1/(omega). And the last component that we need is to introduce this background of relic A primes. And what this does is that it causes, when this decay of the axion into two A primes occurs, it occurs in the presence of this background of A primes. And so the decays are actually stimulated by the existence of this population of A primes. And it turns out that the enhancement to the decay rate of the decay of these axions, gamma, is enhanced by the temperature of the A primes at redshift zero divided by the frequency of A primes. So you get an additional power of omega here. And this ultimately gives you a spectrum that scales as omega to the minus 3/2, and you get something that is steep enough. And so this is the kind of fits that we get. If you remember all of the radio telescope data points that I talked about as a function of the temperature, and we get the best power law fit, which I discussed earlier, was like a power law of minus 2.6 or so. And you can see here that the point-wise the fit that we get from this model actually does a really good job fitting all of the data points and gives you something that's like chi-squared per degree of freedom of order 1 or so, which is good. This calculation here that we've done includes inhomogeneities and other effects, as well as the an extragalactic background that may be there. We checked that the parameters make sense in terms of existing constraints, like the constraints that I went through earlier, as well as limits on the dark matter lifetime, stellar cooling constraints, which limit how often photons can go into A primes and the dark axion, as well as BBN constraints, which limit the temperature of the relic A primes that we need. So as long as we find that we can very easily fit all of these constraints to get the fit here. Yeah, and the last thing that we need to figure out is whether this is smooth. And this turns out to be a very hard, well, it's hard for us. Like, it's really confusing for us. Like, we essentially have to calculate some kind of two-point function for the temperature fluctuations in the sky. And the extremely preliminary result is that it is very smooth. So these are the constraints that I showed you earlier on the smooth. And the model seems to be suggesting that it is quite smooth at small scales. And the reason is because unlike the case where, you know, the Holder case that I showed you earlier, where they assume that that the emission was coming from overdense regions, here, because of the parameters that we need, the convergence actually occur at like mean density regions. So regions which are close to the cosmological mean of the plasma mass. And so this has a very different behavior to, you know, correlations with structures. And so we think we do get something that is very smooth, but this is very preliminary, and there are a lot of issues with this that we still don't fully understand, and we're still working on figuring this out. But anyway, the punchline is that we think we have a new dark sector model that can explain the cosmic radio background, and this would be really interesting because I think existing explanations, especially the astrophysics ones, aren't able to get the right amplitude of the signal. And then the sort of new physics ones run into, you know, like many times the power laws that you get aren't very good, or they need, you know, supermassive black holes at Z of 20. And there are actually some constraints that on that I didn't mention in this talk. But we think this dark sector model actually interestingly evades many of these constraints and can explain the cosmic radio background. With that, let me just conclude and take any additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Hongwan. Yeah, any more questions or comments for Hongwan?
Well, yeah, I didn't quite follow the point you were making just now. Yeah, this slide. About like the power spectrum, so this excess, like you were saying, I thought that so this comes from like decays of dark matter in some sense, and so then like why is this not just tracing like the matter power spectrum?
Right. I mean, it does to some small extent, right? So sorry, I had to go through this quite quickly, but you do get decays of these A to A primes, but this can occur at very, very early times, and then the conversion occurs at late times. And so ultimately, it is the sort of the fluctuations at the point of conversion that dominates the clumpiness of the signal that you get, because this tends to occur very, very early. Does that make sense? You can have you can have these like dark matter processes occurring at very, very early times and like continuing to occur, and then these convert at some late point. And so by that time you've kind of lost a lot of the correlation, except for like cases where you have a decay and it instantaneously converts. I don't know if that I explained that well. Yeah.
Yeah, so you're saying that this like decay lifetime is like very short compared to the age of the universe at this time. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying that the spectrum that you get, like this conversion occurs, and across the entire spectrum, like it occurs. Okay, yeah, I don't know why I'm being so unclear, but you have these decays that are occurring over time, right? So you have decays that are occurring at very early times, and they produce this A prime spectrum.
But there's some lifetime for this decay, right?
There is some lifetime for this decay. The lifetime is longer than the age of the universe because we need the axion to be the dark matter. But all I'm saying is that when the conversion happens from A primes to gamma, many of these A primes were produced long, long ago, right? So this...
Well, like, but most of them, I guess, will be recent decay. I mean, right?
Well, it depends. It's like it's a function of frequency, right? Like,
Yeah, but there's much more time at low redshift than high redshift. So therefore, you know, most of your decays in a logarithmic sense are happening, you know, recently within like a factor of two of your current redshift or something, right?
Yes, but they will all be kind of clustered here, right? And then it depends on where these radio telescopes are sensitive to, right? So they're sensitive at a particular frequency. So I think for these frequencies that we're considering here, they correspond to decays that occurred well in the past.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So we think that the chief, like the thing that generates the most important correlations are at the conversion point. So for example, if these conversions occur only in overdensities, then you would be correlated to overdensities. Whereas this is less important. Although there is a small, there is an effect, but we think this is more important. Although maybe we could be wrong, like we're still working on this and maybe we think about it more clearly. But my expectation is that for a large part of the spectrum, it corresponds to decays that occur very, very early. And so they occur in a part of the universe where things are very, very smooth. So the correlation is not so severe.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Actually, can we stop the recording now?
Sorry?
Yeah.
No, it's not.
What a giveaway.